You are in room 5, the Many Faces of Dam Removal. If that's not where you wanted to be, you can find your way out. My name is Brad Tyer, and I am here as managing editor of Texas Observer, a magazine based in Austin. I'm a little bit dislocated at the moment because I just moved back to Austin, spent the better part of the last 10 years working in Missoula, Montana. That's where I wrote this book, which I'm contractually obligated to point out to you. It's for sale in the Tennessee bookstore, and if 500 copies get sold, I might cover my airfare out here, so feel free to help me out. The way we're going to work this today is I'm going to introduce these folks and our fellow panelists, and then we're going to show a little bit of video, and then we're going to kind of discuss our various areas of expertise, and we're going to save at a minimum 30 minutes for Q&A from you guys. And I'll let them introduce themselves a little more fully as we go along. To my left, we have Stephen Hawley. He's the author of Recovering a Lost River, Removing Dams, Rewilding Salmon, and Revitalizing Communities. It came out on Beacon Press last year. Steve lives in Hood River.
Yep.
And glad he could come down here with us today. His area of expertise is, in large part, sort of the large charismatic dams of the Pacific Northwest. To his left, we have an absence. Sorry to say that Trip Bolton, Fish Habitat and Fish Passage Coordinator with Fish and Wildlife Service, was unable to be here for reasons that by now you're probably familiar with. Luckily, we have Garrett Jobsis, Southeast Regional Director of American Rivers. Garrett and Trip have worked together before, so Garrett's going to be doing a little bit of heavy lifting for us today to try and cover some of the bases that that Trip's not here to cover. Steve, you want to introduce yourself briefly, and Garrett, introduce yourself a little more fully briefly, and then we'll get into the video.
All right, everybody can hear me? I'm actually a recovering high school English teacher from about 15 years back, so I tend to have this booming English teacher voice. I'll try to modulate my voice with a microphone. I do indeed live in Hood River, Oregon, and Brad left this part out. I've actually worked for him before when he was the manager of the Missoula Independent in Montana.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, me too, almost. But I of course, grew up along the big Columbia River between Oregon and Washington, and the story of salmon has been one that fascinated me from a young age. And finished graduate school in Montana and decided I was going to try to write a book about it. And the first thing that somebody told me is, you know, the saying used to be that you could walk across the backs of the salmon to get across the Columbia River, and now you can walk across the backs of books about salmon that have been written about the Columbia River. So it was kind of a good way to start a book project, knowing that there are lots of books on the shelf about the issue. I won't launch too far into the topic before we watch the film clip. I have a wife and a son and daughter in Hood River, and last I talked to them about a half hour ago, they were safely on their way to school, and am freelancing still and still very much active in the sort of river world. I freelance for the Drake magazine, which is a fly fishing magazine based in Colorado. Leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'm Garrett Jobsis. I'm Southeast Regional Coordinator for American, or Director for American Rivers. American Rivers is a national river conservation organization. This is actually our 40th anniversary. So we started in 1973. It was a very organic beginning of about 20 people throwing in $20 each to try to start a nonprofit that would help protect the nation's rivers. So now 40 years later, we're headquartered in Washington, D.C. We have offices around the country. In the southeast, we work in the Carolinas, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama, and have staff in both North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Our goal is to restore and protect the nation's rivers, and over this time, we've worked at either restoring or protecting about 150,000 miles of river around the nation. That sounds like a lot, but there are millions of miles of river around the nation, so it's still a small part of that. We work on various different programs, and one of them is our dam removal program. We've been involved in more than 250 dam removals around the country, and I'll be talking some more about that a bit later.
Okay. Well, we are at the video portion of the program. We've got some video of the Condit Dam removal, which is that?
Just real quickly.
Give us a setup.
Two years ago, this was the largest dam removal in U.S. history in terms of the size of the structure that was taken out. And normally when they remove a dam, you know, there's a big ceremony, a ribbon cutting. One that they took out, they even put dyes in the smoke of the charges, that, you know, so that it would look really pretty for the television cameras. But then after that initial charge, where they sort of blow the crest of the dam, and there's heavy equipment that just sort of typewriters down each level of the concrete till they reach the level of the river. This one was in a slot canyon, and they couldn't get heavy equipment across the crest of the dam, and so they actually blew out the bottom of it. So what you'll be looking at is a communal, probably the first in world history, a communal act of monkey wrenching, where they actually, a whole bunch of people got together and agreed that the best way to take out this dam was to blow it up.
Is that pretty clear? Should we turn down
the screen? Yeah, I will.
Yeah, right. We'll be making it larger. Should we turn down the lights, or is that, we'll let it go?
Everybody see? All right.
So with that, I want to turn it over to Steve. We've got about 12 minutes or so.
Sure.
To talk about some of the projects you're familiar with up in the Northwest.
Okay, well, that one was on the White Salmon River, which is, if you step out on the road behind my house and look across the Columbia, you can see the mouth of the White Salmon. I'm gonna, in the time I have allotted here, I guess, banjo music. Sorry, folks. I actually planned this little musical accompaniment to my speaking. All right. The musical introduction is over now. Two things. The resiliency of river systems to come back after they've been dammed for sometimes more than a century. This one was exactly a century. I guess, you know, one of the things that the reasons the dams are removed is for the charismatic megafauna, but there's also a sort of ecosystem-wide rebound that occurs, and as we've taken out more and more dams, of course, the rate at which these river systems return has been widely studied, and what people are finding is they actually come back much faster than most biologists had even estimated. That's the first thing. The second thing is sort of that I want to talk about is just the process, how dams are being taken out all over the country. We'll start with the charismatic megafauna first. That dam was taken out for the sake of Chinook salmon. And, you know, it's sort of interesting if you look at the way the dams were built. It's a perfect example of the way society applies new technology, right? We built, I think there's something like 75,000 dams on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers list of structures across the country. Is that right? 84,000, okay. And a lot of these were built, you know, in the 20th century, and they were done so without, you know, there were no environmental laws or policies on the books. There wasn't much consideration for aesthetic values, recreation values of any kind. Of course, that all changed, and so there were all kinds of adaptations made to the dams after they were built to try to account for the values that people had, you know, developed after, you know, mostly after the Second World War. So on the Columbia, and you know, they've retrofitted dams with fish passage, which means instead of waiting for the spill gates to open or going over the crest of the dam, they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars actually, you know, drilling in the backside of the a hole in the backside of the dam and for dams for salmon to swim through. There's these things on the face of the dams called flip lips that are supposed to slow the water so that, you know, if a fish goes over the crest of the dam, it gets the bends, right? What same thing a diver gets when it comes up too quickly? It's nitrogen poisoning. Anyway, none of those things worked, and so probably 15 years ago, after spending billions of dollars, some dams started being taken out. And what they found, not just in the Columbia, but down on the West Coast, was this was exactly the sort of biological recovery for salmon that they hadn't been able to do with sort of the retrofitting technologies that had come along over the past 50 years. So, for instance, is that too close to the mic? Can everybody hear me? Okay. There's a small stream in the book that I wrote a chapter about this stream in my book that some of you picked up. It's called Butte Creek, which is a tributary of the Sacramento. And Butte Creek's a really interesting story. There was a run of spring Chinook on Butte Creek that in the 80s was down to less than 20 fish. So as biologists use the term functionally, you know, extinct, because there's not enough of them to of a population base to keep the restore the population. Well, they took out four low dams on a tributary of Butte Creek, and this was in the early 90s. And in 1998, they had a run of 30,000 Chinook salmon that came back to Butte Creek. And this is the point at which people started scratching their heads and saying, well, this could really be a tool for river restoration that is not without its controversies, but nonetheless is really effective. So salmon, of course, is probably the iconic fish species of the West, and that's why most dam removals in the western United States, particularly in the territory of salmon, that's the reason that they're coming out. It's not limited to that. Brad will talk about a one in Montana that is a, sort of a unique story. On the East Coast, everybody, I guess the first dam removal that got a lot of national press attention was on the Kennebec. In 1999, Bruce Babbitt was there. It was in Augusta, Maine. You know, they rang all the church bells in the town as the dam was being removed. And again, it was this big media show with, you know, many, many speakers. And I guess this isn't really charismatic megafauna, and maybe I'm being kind of a West Coast snob, but people from Maine are already, you know, calling for my head, but the species that they were trying to get to return in the Kennebec is this small herring with a kind of unfortunate name. It's called an alewife, right? And they're a sort of a baseline of the food chain in that system. And again, the recovery there has just been remarkable. There were relatively few, maybe a few thousand of these herring that were coming back to the base of the dam. The dam was built in 1837, right? So it had been there for 160 years. Within a decade of, I think in 2008, when they took out another dam upstream on a tributary of the Kennebec, there were more than 5 million alewives that had returned to the system. So maybe the alewife wasn't a charismatic megafauna, but the picture that sticks in my mind from that removal is there was a harbor seal that swam probably 20 miles upstream of Augusta. It's the first, harbor seal to swim up that river system since the Whigs were a national political sensation. So, again, the recovery has just exceeded all expectations, and it's sort of, I guess, the last charismatic megafauna that we should talk about is real estate agents, because what's happened on the Kennebec is that property values along the river, which, you know, this was a sort of 19th century textile mill economy. And so, you know, the town of Augusta was using the Kennebec as kind of a toilet to flush all the industrial effluent downstream. And for the first time in a century and a half, the architecture of that town is actually turning back toward the river, and values of property along the river have actually risen. So it's sort of an unintended, you know, everybody knew the recreation benefits might be there, but there's been kind of another economic boost that wasn't anticipated at all. Okay, so that's I could name some other charismatic megafauna, but I'll shift gears here really quickly, and we'll talk about 5 minutes left. Okay. Wow, I'm doing really well managing my time.
Keep going.
Yeah. The process of dam removal, I'm going to talk about it mostly just on the federal level. There is a not very well-known agency called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and particularly in the West, but also in a lot of places in the East, every dam has to have a license, a federal license, and that license is issued by FERC. And I think the story that makes the Kennebec in Maine kind of unique is that for the better part of a century, FERC had just rubber-stamped every 50-year license for a dam that had come across its desk. And in the early, I think it was in 1996, actually, that FERC didn't reissue a license for the dam on the Kennebec. And so this set the stage for the dam to be removed. It was actually at that point just a question of financing it. And if you back up a step from there, this is probably the more interesting part of the story. Most, Garrett and I were talking about this, most of the dams that I know of that have been removed, the idea was initiated really by a group of disgruntled fishermen. It's remarkable how often that's happened. And that was the case on Butte Creek. That was the case on the white salmon. And it was certainly the case on the Kennebec. And so there's sort of a a flow chart, if you will, of how dam removals occur. A group of local people suggest the dam needs to be removed. They run up against the utility or the owners of the dam. And they enlist the local citizens, and their sort of local groups enlist the help of somebody like American Rivers. And that's where the sort of case gets made to FERC or the regulatory agency that has a license for the dam. The big holdup right now, I think, for many, many dam removals is actually financing. We should talk a little bit about the removal that's occurring right now in the state of Washington on the Elwha Dam in Olympic National Park. That removal was actually approved in 2000, early, maybe 2001. It took 10 more years to figure out how they were going to pay for it. And so these things are cheap. I think to remove Condit Dam, the budget was in the neighborhood of $10 or $12 million. The reason this is happening, you know, I remember in high school and first couple of years of college reading all of Edward Abbey's novels, and of course the Monkey Wrench Gang is this story about this roving band of eco-terrorists who blow up a dam. It was so far out on the spectrum of possibilities for the environmental movement that it seemed like it would never happen. So you could write a fiction novel about it. The reason it's happening is that two things: environmental regulations and then safety. States that have strong dam safety regulations are removing dams because, you know, particularly privately owned dams, the utilities are looking at the costs of upgrading the dams to meet modern safety and environmental standards, and in many cases, it's just cheaper to take them out. So the last thing I guess I'll mention quickly here is that we have yet to remove a large federal project for the simple reason that in the infinite wisdom of the federal government, they exempted themselves from the FERC licensing process, right? So taking out a dam like Glen Canyon, simply to make that happen, Glen Canyon is in Utah, was the subject of Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrench Gang. To take out a dam on that scale would require an act of Congress. And so this has set up some really interesting scenarios where with the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, the Wilderness Act, there are values that are sort of being encroached upon by the dams themselves. On the Snake River, for instance, the largest roadless area in the lower 48, the Snake, I should back up a step, is a tributary of the Columbia. The largest roadless area in the lower 48 states was set aside by Idaho Senator Frank Church in the 60s as a sanctuary for wild salmon. At the same time that was happening, they were finishing the, you know, the last of the 430 dams that exist on the Columbia and Snake. And so it'll be interesting to see, looking ahead into the future, whether this sort of clash of values, this sort of utilization of rivers for industrial and technological needs, how that plays out on the scale of large federal dams, between the sort of recreational environmental values and technical and industrial needs. The Columbia is an interesting case right now because all those dams were built during and after the war, mostly to power aluminum smelters. But the industry that's moving in now is zeroed out. Okay.
I'll just wrap it up.
Okay. The industry that I'm actually almost at the end. This is amazing. The industry that's moving in now is the data center business. Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, they're all building, some of them are actually building right over the sites of former aluminum smelters because there is super, super cheap electricity there. So a town just upstream from me, the Dalles, there's a Google data center there that uses the same amount of electricity as about the city of Tacoma in Washington, and they get it for super cheap. So that's it for me.
Until we get to questions, you can't leave.
I will not leave.
All right, that's we're going to move over to Garrett now, who's going to talk, bring this question home a little bit into the Southeast region before we pop back up to Montana. And I think you had a couple of good transitions out of what Steve was talking
to.
Yeah,
your topic. We'll find out if they're good or not.
So
we'll go over to Garrett. You got about 12 minutes or so.
All right. Again, I'm Garrett Yopsis with American Rivers. So American Rivers, as I mentioned before, one of the things we focus on is taking out dams. And the reason we do that is because dams, perhaps more than any other feature in our rivers, do a lot of damage. They block fish migration, so migratory fish such as the salmon in the west, but also in the east coast, we have fish that have the same life cycle where they spend most of their life in the ocean and migrate up in the rivers to spawn. Those are fish like American shad, blueback herring, the alewives, short-nosed and Atlantic sturgeon, which are both federally endangered species, have that same life cycle. So they need access to their native spawning grounds to be able to complete their life cycle. So dams obviously block fish passage. They also can affect water quality. They do affect water quality, especially with dissolved oxygen and temperature. And they do the bad things generally is that they make dissolved oxygen lower. And they raise water temperatures in the summer and often lower water temperatures in the winter. So the opposite that you want. So it basically can have a tremendous effect. And some of the salmon spawning areas, some of the cold water species that live below some of these dams can't spawn because the water is too warm or the oxygen is too low. They also block sediments. And that might sound good, but it's actually sediment transport is a part of the natural process of rivers that they carry along what's called a bed load that moves silt and sand and gravel and cobble downriver. As part of the natural process. And when you put a dam there, it stops that. It does two things. One, it blocks that sediment from being transported downstream, so it accumulates in the impoundments, causes them to fill up with sediment, as you witnessed from that very good video that Andy Macer did. And also, by blocking that, they create a sediment deficit downstream, so this water is hungry for moving sediment, and it actually increases the erosion rates downstream, causes more downcutting of the channel, so you come up with these incised channels that don't sustain aquatic life as well. And finally, they change the habitat. An impoundment, again, they become full of sediment, they're slow, they're stagnant. Riverine fish and wildlife evolved in a flowing environment, so they need flowing water. And often in the southeast, where we have a high biodiversity, you can have 90% fewer species in the impoundment than you have in the natural river system. So the habitat is just not there. So those are reasons why they need to be removed from the process of rivers. Steve also touched on human safety is a big part of this. Unlike most people, I mean, most people think that dams help with flooding. Actually, dams create flooding hazards. Unless a dam is actively managed for flood protection, it actually creates more of a hazard for flooding for two reasons. One is that it creates a blockage in the river that does not allow water to be transferred downstream, so it rises the water level and can create flooding upstream of the dam, backing water up into tributaries and the sewers into towns. And also the danger of failure, where when there is a failure, it does create tremendous flooding hazard downstream. So again, dams actually increase flooding, not reduce them, unless they're specifically managed for flood protection. And also dams create recreational hazards. Every year, unfortunately, we have a number of people around the country who drown below dams because of the currents that are set up as the water spills over or is discharged from the dams. Literally sucks people and boats and pets and whatever else into these boils and of water, and they can't come out. So as Steve also mentioned, sometimes the real reason a lot of dams are removed, even though the target may be for fish and wildlife, initially, some of the real reasons that they're removed are because of the flooding hazards and also because of the liability associated with the hazardous dams. And while Steve was talking about some very great dam removals out west, the Condit Dam we saw the video of, the Elwha Dam, dams on the Snake River that need to come out, most of the dams in the country are not those kinds that are being removed. Most of them are small. They average about 100 to 200 feet across. They're about 10 to 12 feet high. And most of them don't cost millions of dollars to remove. They actually cost, on average, about $100,000 to $350,000 to take out these dams. There's one in North Carolina we were lucky enough to work on where actually it cost $10,000 to remove a dam. One guy in a backhoe for a week, and he was done. So there's tremendous opportunity to do this nationwide. Our database shows that we have about 1,100 dams have been removed around the country. Tens of thousands of miles have been restored because of that. In the southeast, we have about 85 dams have been removed. In North Carolina, we have 17 dams that have come out. One I'll show a video of just came out just about 6 weeks ago. But while this sounds great, we're taking these dams out, it's really less than 1% of the dams that we have in the country that have been removed. So we have a tremendous problem with the industrial legacy of these dams. Most of them, again, are abandoned. They're old mill dams from the 19th and 20th century, early 20th century. that are still there that aren't being used, are abandoned, they're in poor repair, and something needs to be done about it. So the states that have been effective in removing these dams are those that have the right mindset, that have the proper permitting perspective. Pennsylvania is a great example of a state. They have a statewide dam removal program. They use dam removal as mitigation for other environmental impacts. Their Department of Transportation is actually going out seeking dam removal projects to mitigate for their for the impacts of their highway construction. So states that really get it are the ones that that are removing a lot of dams. A lot of states don't get it, and there can be roadblocks. So I'm going to show you a picture here. These are the dams in North and South Carolina. And this is not an unusual image. As a matter of fact, you have more dams in a lot of the New England states. These aren't even all the dams. These are just the dams that are part of the state dam safety program database. About 8,000 dams in North and South Carolina. Again, we've taken out 17. So we're a long way from unclogging these rivers of the legacy of our industrial past. Most of these dams are no longer serving a public purpose. They are just left there. So one thing American Rivers is trying to focus on is how do we get from taking out 1 to maybe 10 dams a year in these two states? And we have never gotten to 10. I think 7 is the most we've gotten. But how do we go from taking that out to actually being effective in restoring our rivers and reducing the impacts of these dams? So our goal is to find ways to scale this up, and we do this through several measures. One is we conduct trainings, the American Rivers method, I would say, but we have a pretty efficient and effective way of taking dams out, and we do trainings around the Southeast and around the country. Actually, just this year in Nashville, Tennessee, the state of Tennessee gave us a grant to come in and train their staff on how to take out dams. It was standing room only capacity, over 50 people there from state agencies and other federal agencies and nonprofit organizations to get training on how to take out dams. So one of the ways that we can scale up dam removal is by teaching others how to do it. Another thing is changing policy. Unfortunately, a lot of the federal and state permitting processes look at dam removal the same way as they look at construction of a highway or of a shopping center. So they look at it as a development activity rather than as restoration activity. And so an example in North Carolina where there is an old dam that's not being used and has an impoundment, the permitting process is going to require mitigation for the fringe wetlands around this reservoir that are going to be lost when the river is drained, when the pond is drained and the river is restored. So the mindset, and it's not the individual's fault, it's just that this is the way the policies and the permit rules are written. So we need to change that so it's recognized that when you're doing a benefit like restoring rivers by taking out dams, you're not being evaluated the same way as somebody who's building a shopping center on the edge of the river would be evaluated. We also need to find out ways to reduce costs. Again, tens of millions of dollars to remove some of these big dams in the West, and that's because they are huge dams. But most of our dams are much smaller and much less costly. One of the most important, the biggest cost of dam removal is associated with sediments. Brad's going to talk about a contaminated sediment issue out in Montana behind a dam. But our perspective is that unless the sediments are contaminated, or totally overwhelming, would overwhelm the system, that they shouldn't be removed. They should be allowed to flow downstream as part of the natural process. I mean, sediment movement, as I said before, is part of what rivers do. They move sediments, and if you let the river be a river and move the sediments as it should, you may have some short-term impacts from the removal, but long-term you're going to create a much healthier river by getting more of these dams out. So, again, reducing costs is another way that that we can effectively ramp up the amount of dam removal. And the final thing I want to touch on is creating the right tools. One thing we did in North Carolina is created a GIS database of all these dams. And actually, this is just a subset of the dams. These are the ones that are in the state and dam safety program registry, but there are probably about 50,000 dams in the Carolinas when you count all the farm ponds and smaller unregulated dams. So we work to build a GIS database that would give us the ability to make rational decisions on where to prioritize our work. It includes what species are there. Are there endangered species involved? Are there anadromous species, fish that migrate up from the ocean to spawn in the freshwater streams? How many miles of river would be restored? Are there water supply reservoirs? Obviously, it's difficult to remove a dam that's a water supply reservoir, so we need to know what those are. So we created this GIS tool that does allow us to go in now and be more efficient in prioritizing where we do work to get the biggest bang for hopefully not very many bucks. The good thing is that the South Atlantic Landscape Conservation Collaborative, which is under the Department of Interior, recognize the benefit of our tool for North Carolina, and they're now expanding this to a large part of the Southeast. So we're going to have a decision tool in the Southeast that will help fish and wildlife agencies, nonprofits, and others prioritize where they do their work. So, again, to get from taking out a few dams to the thousands of dams we need to take out every year to be able to really start effectively restoring our rivers is a major step, and that's what American Rivers is focusing on.
Very good. Did you have a video?
I do, but that's Tripp's presentation, which I'm going to do next.
Oh.
Shall I keep on going?
I lost track.
So anyway, Tripp Bolton with the Fish and Wildlife Service can't be here, and unfortunately. And he's been the Fish and Wildlife Service has been a very effective partner, and so I thought I would talk a little bit about what Tripp and the Fish and Wildlife Service have been doing. Again, the Fish and Wildlife Service is a leader nationwide on removing some of these dams, and in the Southeast, they've been a very effective partner and actually leader. They provide technical oversight. They provide the biologists who can do the assessments to see what the priority species are. They also have the opportunity to provide federal funding. And one thing that started just last year is a collaborative between American Rivers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we hope is going to become a model for the rest of the country where American Rivers and our partners are going out identifying dams. We're working to get the engineering studies done, the designs done, so that these dams can be taken out. But again, one of the factors with dam removals, even if they're $100,000 to $350,000 to take it out, it's still a lot of money. So what Fish and Wildlife Service has done is they have now dedicated some of their National Wildlife Refuge staff to be able to work on these dam removals. Again, one thing Fish and Wildlife Service does is manage these national wildlife refuges, and they have heavy equipment operators that operate bulldozers, track hoes, and things like that. And so what we have done now on three dams, two last year, one this year, and two more coming up this fall, is get the Fish and Wildlife Service operators to come up. They're actually based in Mississippi, but they come up to North Carolina. We rent the equipment, and they take these dams out. We did two dams in 1 week last year. And we just removed one, again, on the Lassiter Mill Dam, which you'll see a video of in just a minute. So this is a pretty innovative approach that Fish and Wildlife Service has taken. We're hoping that this reduction in cost is going to open up more opportunities to take more dams out. So what I want to focus on now, I'll go to now, is a short video clip of this dam removal on the Uwharry River, North Carolina, which is spelled U-W-H-A-R-R-I-E. That opened up about 189 miles of river and tributaries for American shad and other species that are that need that for spawning habitat.
Excavators chisel and dig to remove Lassiter Mill Dam in the Uwharry River in Randolph County, North Carolina. This structure was 200 feet long and stood 12 feet high as part of a gritsmill operation dating back to 1805. Prior to demolition, the Lassiter Mill building collapsed on its own, but the concrete structure was still standing, creating a wall that turned the free-flowing river into a stagnant pond. Too slow, too deep, and too silty for the mussels and fish that need the natural, shallow, fast-flowing waters to survive. But all of this changed on August 27, 2013, when demolition began. The goal? To restore the health of the river. A team of biologists that surveyed the area in May confirmed the presence of rare aquatic wonders unique to the Piedmont region of central North Carolina. The Ouari River is habitat for 16 species of fish, mussels, and salamanders that are considered rare, threatened, or endangered. Removing Lassiter Mill Dam opened up 189 river miles. A popular fish that will benefit from this restoration is the savory American shad. In a few years, Duke Energy Progress plans to trap and transport over 20,000 American shad and release the fish into the PD River above areas currently blocked. Two more dams in the same watershed are scheduled for removal in the next year to fully reconnect the Ouari River. A strong partnership between many organizations made this restoration project possible, and we hope to see many more obsolete dams removed in North Carolina and throughout the Southeast region.
And so I'm sorry that Tripp Bolton can't be here. He would have been an excellent addition to our panel. But again, Fish and Wildlife Service is doing really great things in the Southeast and across the country. Just take our hats off to the folks there that work so hard to get it done. And they're part of the solution to help take some of the remnants of our past out of these rivers to help restore them for fish and wildlife habitat and also for happy paddling.
Glad somebody mentioned paddling. That's my primary interest. All right, thank you, Garrett. I'm going to try and blow through my section pretty quick.
Going to try and move through this section pretty quickly here so that we've got time for questions. My interest in dam removal started with paddling. We moved to Missoula, Montana in 2002 and started paddling some of those rivers, and it took me a couple of months to realize that what I was actually paddling on the Clark Fork River, which is the main river that goes through Missoula, was the largest, it just in terms of land area, largest Superfund site in the United States. I wish I had a map or had thought to do that, but just to kind of orient you. The Clark Fork basically runs from the Continental Divide, its headwaters, near Butte, Montana, and it flows generally northwest for about 120 miles to Missoula, and then onward through Missoula, joins the Columbia at, or joins the Flathead, and then Lake Pend'Oreille, and then into the Columbia system. Butte, Montana, was a major copper mining center in the late 1800s and early 1900s, into mid-century, really. A lot of very dirty, very low-tech copper mining and smelting up there in the upper parts of the Clark Fork watershed. In 1908, Milltown Dam was built by William A. Clark, one of the original copper barons of the area. Soon after it was built, the dam was built basically to provide electricity to the Missoula Mill over in western Montana, which then shipped timbers back upstream to stave the mines in Butte. So it was kind of a closed-circuit economic system there. The dam was built in 1908 to provide electricity to the local mills. Several weeks after the dam was completed, a 500-year flood hit the Clark Fork watershed and basically blew a lot of mine tailings and smelter waste that had been left laying on the ground downstream. Piled up behind the dam, a lot of nickel, cadmium, arsenic, lead. Arsenic was the big problem. Fast forward to the early 1980s, and some routine well tests in the area started turning up dangerous levels of arsenic in the local wells. Took several years to figure out why. Nobody quite knew. The flood of 1908 had become kind of a distant memory. But over the course of several years of study, it was determined that basically most of Butte's mine waste had blown down and stacked up behind this dam, and under the hydraulic head of that lake was seeping into the aquifer, which is, at the time, it was influencing wells in small communities just east of Missoula, but this is upstream, same aquifer, upstream of Missoula. So EPA designated it a Superfund site and then started figuring out how, and the Superfund site sort of flowed upstream in a series of designations going all the way back upstream to Butte. And we've got environmental journalists in the room who've probably read about Butte and the Berkeley Pit It's a large strip mine up there at the headwaters. That's been the charismatic megafauna of that process.
We went there 2 years ago.
Oh, well, yeah, no, I was there, right, yeah. So what happened is this is a story that's got a dam removal at the center of it, but the more I've learned about dam removal, I think this is kind of an outlier in terms of the why and the how for. There wasn't one factor that originated this dam removal project. This is a dam that got caught up in the fight over a Superfund cleanup. It was the centerpiece. What are we going to do with this? So once we got the Superfund designation, people started arguing about what to do about it. What to do about it was one or another of various strategies of drying up, digging out the lake, and moving that sediment, which was toxic in place, to a safer repository. In comes a local nonprofit called the Clark Fork Coalition in Missoula, Montana. Wonderful folks do wonderful work, but they see an opportunity here to take this old dam, which is no longer providing a significant amount of electricity to the community and has got some licensing issues, and maybe more to the point, has blocked a very charismatic confluence of two rivers. Puddled up behind the Milltown Dam is the confluence of the Clark Fork and the Blackfoot River. And the Blackfoot River might be familiar to you from river runs through it, right? So a very famous river. There was a lot of local nonprofit and public relations weight put behind the idea of taking this dam out and piggybacking that dam removal on the process of the Superfund cleanup. So you had a couple of things that came together. One is a very effective public relations campaign in Missoula to have that dam taken out. In 1996, fortuitously enough, there was a crazy large 10-mile ice flow that came barreling down the Blackfoot River, threatened the Milltown Dam. And that sort of brought the whole question into a public safety realm. They ended up having to drop the reservoir behind the dam in an attempt to strand that ice flow so that it wouldn't blow the dam out. Instead, it just blew out all that sediment, blew it over the dam, and caused a big fish kill downstream. So in 96, weather entered the equation and kind of cooperated, raising some public awareness of some public safety issues with the dam. 2 years later, bull trout were listed as endangered, threatened, I believe, listed as threatened. And that added another element to this. There was no fish passage involved with the Milltown Dam, and the idea of retrofitting it just added, you know, another maintenance cost to the idea of maintaining the dam. So all these things kind of came together at the right time and in the right place to lead to the removal of Milltown Dam. Then there was the question of how to do it. And that's where the dam removal took kind of another turn into an environmental justice question that is central to the book that I wrote about this. Most dam removals, you don't have to dig up the lake behind them and move it somewhere else, dig up the lake bed behind them and move it somewhere else. So there were strategies bandied back and forth, and there were arguments bandied back and forth between various stakeholders in the community and ARCO, which is the company that had inherited the liability for the Superfund site. They were going to be responsible for the cleanup. Initially, the idea is that the lake would have been drained. Basically, the river would have been put into a pipe, moved around the site, dry up that lake bed, dig that up, move it out to a site, a repository, essentially on-site, that was going to be built for maintaining this this material out of the floodway. That was the EPA's initial recommendation, but it's not the recommendation that they ended up following. As soon as EPA put out their recommendation to dig up the lake bed, remove the dam, store the wastes on site, a kind of unholy coalition of Missoula citizens, nonprofit advocacy groups, Montana State Senator, Montana federal senator, Max Baucus, billionaire businessman Dennis Washington, and the EPA got together and decided that, no, they would actually rather not store all this waste in Missoula's backyard. They would actually rather clean that up and have it be a community asset. So what they were going to do instead is they were going to reroute the river, they were going to dry up the lake bed, they were going to dig that material up, and for 2 years running, daily, they were going to send trains 100 miles back upstream carrying this material and dumping it at a pre-existing waste repository site on the outskirts of a community called Opportunity, Montana. Opportunity, Montana had been, it was basically a 4,000-acre site, used to be ponds. They called in the Opportunity Ponds. They're not actually ponds. They're plateaus now, 50 to 70 feet deep with smelter waste. All through the 20th century, they had been the designated repository for the copper mining smelter waste in the area. So that had been defunct since the early 80s when the smelter went out of business. That site was pressed back into service now to take these additional wastes, and that's kind of what grabbed my interest about this story, is that this is a little community that had paid the price for 100 years worth of industrial resource extraction wealth, and now it was being pressed back into service to sort of enable this restoration economy that was going on over in western Montana. So and that's what eventually ended up happening. There was a bill of goods was sold to the community of Opportunity, Montana. There was a very funny theory that these toxic heavy metals were going to be dug up here, moved upstream, spread out on top of the Opportunity Pond site, and there it was supposed to function as topsoil so that you could grow plant material and keep the dust tamped down. That was the promise that was made to the community sort of in response to their understandable dismay that they were going to be dumped on again. That didn't turn out to be true. In fact, what was advertised as just a little bit and not as bad as what you already have was quite a lot and multiple times worse in terms of its toxicity than what it was covering. So it created more problems upstream. The dam removal itself was a demonstrably good thing. The river, I do a little bit of writing for the Drake as well, and did a piece a couple of months ago talking to local fish trout guides, and the river's coming back in terms of its biological health. The aquifer is coming back in terms of human health. But this was a case where there was an unintended or at least an unadvertised side effect. Removing this waste and moving it required a place to move it to, and so a small politically underrepresented community ended up kind of getting buried under the byproduct of this otherwise positive removal. That's what this book's about, and that's kind of the outlying story of the Milltown Dam removal. And I believe I've probably gone over my time, but this would be the time to turn it over to questions. We've got about half an hour, which is what they asked us to do. So I was told journalist first, and so I will ask you to say your name, and then I'm going to restate the question, and we can figure out where to send it. Yes, sir. Brian, hello.
So in the Great Lakes, there's some basic research, and we have sand runs as well, for those who don't know. And then they're bringing up some polychlorinated phenols upstream with them as kind of an unintended side effect. And I'm guessing the ecological benefits outweigh that, but I'm wondering if American Rivers, if that's on your radar at all.
It's not on my radar. I don't work in the Great Lakes area. We have been active in removing dams in the Great Lakes, trying to, again, remove the barriers that you know for Great Lakes fish to be able to go up in the rivers and spawn. But I'm not familiar with that issue at all.
Steve, have you heard of that? I was not.
Been on the Muskegon?
Boardman.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard of that.
I appreciate your data is sort of showing how small, how few dams are being removed. But, I guess I have a question. I've been hearing about this trend for 15 years, that maybe it's not a trend. I mean, how many dams are being built compared to the number of dams that are being removed? It certainly seems like Georgia is happy to build more dams.
And for the recording, I'm going to restate the question. We're talking about the trend of dam removal over the last 15 years versus sort of a counter trend of dams being proposed and built as well. I'm glad you brought that up because we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, this is Garrett Yopsis. It certainly is a valid point. There is a trend of increasing dam removal, so there's no doubt about that. There is, over the past 10 or 15 years, there have been more dams coming out, even though we're not at our goal yet. We are working at more dam removal projects nationwide. There are also new dams being built, not just in Georgia. These are reported to be water supply reservoirs, as people in the media probably know that Georgia and Atlanta in particular faced some real water challenges in 2007, 2008, 2009. So the state is actually actively promoting dam building. Most of those dams, however, are not really needed for water supply. There's just an opportunity to now build your dam and create your amenity reservoir and call it water supply. So one thing American Rivers is working on, actually EPA Region 4 is working on, is coming up with ways of evaluating these dams to make sure that they, first of all, are truly needed, are truly water supply reservoirs and not just amenity reservoirs. And secondly, that that they are doing the proper steps of avoiding and minimizing the potential effects of these dams before they go about constructing them. So EPA Region 4 has come up with what is called the affectionately known as the WEGs, the Water Efficiency Guidelines, and it states a number of steps that a dam builder has to go through if it's a water supply reservoir. A number of steps they have to go through to show that they're using all other water efficiency techniques that would be applicable to avoid the need for this new dam. The steps that EPA has put together is being shared with the Corps of Engineers, which done is the federal permitting of these reservoirs. And there are meetings right now with EPA, the Corps, American Rivers, and others on implementing these new guidelines.
Chime in for a second. A big issue with new dams and climate change regime that we're, Steve Hawley, for the sake of posterity, is evaporative loss. So on the Colorado system, evaporative loss is the second biggest water user in Glen Canyon Dam. It's irrigation first, evaporative loss, and then domestic and industrial use. And so there's some question about, as longer, hotter summers evolve, whether or not building new dams is actually an effective water storage tool if you're losing, 10 to 15% of reservoir capacity every summer through evaporation. Is it really going to be worth the price to build a new dam, let alone keep the existing ones? There are all kinds of engineering feats that are going to happen to keep some of those big dams on the Colorado functioning into the mid-century.
So. Right, and kind of following up on that, this is Garrett again, that if you don't have enough water to fill up your dams in the first place, how is building a new dam going to help you with that? Sometimes, and in Georgia, some of the proposed dams are located right upstream of existing dams, so they're going to be capturing water that's going to prevent the existing dams from storing it. So it's not necessarily a well-planned out process, and again, the majority of these dams are not really needed for water supply.
Well, and that does, just real briefly, that does point out, the dam removal craze, dam removal trend anyway, has not made it to all parts of the country, and I'm still learning my way back into Texas, having recently moved back there. Dam removal is not on the radar whatsoever, and new dams are being proposed. So, I'm sorry, who had the next hand? We'll go here at the front row, sir.
Hi. Quick comment on the last subject before I get to my question. Namely, I think in a lot of areas, these you call them amenity dams, I call them real estate dams. And you make a lake to make lakefront cottages, and the developers have tricks for sizing the reservoir so it's just under the regulatory horizon of the state. But at the federal level, not so much, because big federal subsidies for dam building are mostly a thing of the past as well. But my question is, I bet that you guys didn't exhaust the list of all the legal and regulatory obstacles to dam removal. So I wanted to ask.
I'm certain that you're right.
I wanted to ask that question in hopes of giving you more opportunity to talk more about that. Is that a question?
That's a question.
I'm Peter Davis with the Society of Environmental Journalists. So
okay, wonderful. I'm glad you brought that up. The question is, what are the roadblocks, especially the regulatory roadblocks, to dam removal? And one of you gentlemen, I'm not sure which, is... Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Garrett, you want to take that one?
Sure, I'll be glad to answer part of that. There are roadblocks. Again, as I mentioned before, the permitting process can be cumbersome. Those states that really understand, like Pennsylvania, really understand the benefits of dam removal, are permitting them in a way that reduces some of those roadblocks. There are roadblocks also in that there's a mentality not only of the regulators but also of a lot of community people in the community that these dams are part of the legacy and they need to be there forever. You know, the dam is forever type mentality. So dam removal is still seen as sometimes as a kind of a radical approach to river restoration, and sometimes the regulatory community looks at them as kind of a lark rather than as an effective tool for river restoration. There are a number of regulatory hurdles that you have to go through. I don't know if any one of them is a particular bad roadblock, but there's the Endangered Species Act. So if you have endangered species, you actually have to account for what the impacts may be. And sometimes, even though you may have a long-term benefit of taking this dam out, the focus is on the short-term impacts. And obviously, if there's a rare or threatened endangered species there, you have to focus on that. Contaminated sediments, again, when sediments are contaminated, you definitely need to deal with that. But some states require treatment or removal of sediments, even though there's no contamination. That's a huge cost, and that's definitely both a cost in money and a cost in time and effort to deal with those sediments. And finally, I had another point I was going to make. Well, funding is one. Certainly, and the question was about regulatory roadblocks. So certainly, the more regulatory roadblocks there are, the more money you need to kind of overcome those. The one thing I was going to say also in North Carolina, so remember my point. There's a unnecessary affinity for doing stream restoration projects associated with dam removals, as you know. The video showed on the Conda dam removal. They blew out a hell of a lot of sediment. But a year later, you know, there are fish spawning right where all those sediments were. The river has restored itself. So not having to handle the clean sediment, and allowing it to flow downriver and recreate the river channel as it's intended to do is a big benefit that can be a huge expense if the regulations require that removal or require stream restoration, you know, to go back and restore that river. And that actually, we can have a dam removal that might cost, let's say, $300,000, but over $1 million in restoring the stream rather than upstream and downstream, rather than actually allowing the river to recover itself. So in North Carolina especially, that's a big obstacle, is the requirement of stream restoration associated with dam removals.
Well, and then you also had the question about ownership. In Texas, what little I know about that, there's no regulatory teeth. The state can recommend that most of the dams are privately owned. You know, the large majority of these smaller run-of-the-river dams are privately owned. The state can come in and make recommendations in terms of maintenance, in terms of removal, but they can't tell the private property owner what to do. And in a large number of cases, the property owner is not in a financial position to do the dam removal, may not be convinced that there's a reason to do the dam removal. They like their little dam. It's a low water crossing. So there's just really no teeth. That's Texas. You can't tell the private landowner what to do. Garrett, you might address...
Well, I do want to address that, and that is true, but I also want to point out, and I forgot to do this, I meant to mention it earlier, that all of these dam removals we're involved with are... on these smaller dams are voluntary. There's no regulatory requirement. These are people who want to get rid of the dam. Either this Lassiter Mill Dam actually is a great story. The woman that owns that dam, or the former dam, she bought this property and did some genealogical research and stuff and found out that her family back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, was opposed to this dam being built because it was going to block American shad from migrating up the river to their property where they, you know, depended on them for food. So she was especially pleased that she could fulfill the wishes of her ancestors 200 years before to actually get this dam to come out through, you know, through a lot of different circumstances. She ended up owning the property that they were with, where the dam was they were opposed to. So she actually wrote up a piece on that, and the Charlotte Observer also did a little piece on that story. It's a really, really good story. But again, these are all voluntary dam removals. These are sometimes it's the regulatory requirement to do repairs on the dam, or you know, again, Steve mentioned it's more expensive to repair it than to remove it. But again, that's their decision to remove it. They could spend the money and repair it. So the bigger dams out west that are the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission licenses, they license all non-federal hydropower projects, but the ones that Steve's examples, those were, you know, basically required through regulation. But most all the private landowner ones are all voluntary.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of ownership scenarios. I'm not sure we can hit them all. Did we answer your question a bit?
Thanks.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Roberto. I'm a journalist from Brazil. Mm-hmm. I'm on sabbatical here. I'm finishing off my thesis, which is exactly about the trend here, which is the building of a huge dam. It's called Belo Monte, which is the second largest hydroelectric plant in the planet. And my question basically is this, like, how do you measure the environmental impact? I mean, if you have any official information on this, because of course the media coverage, you know, that's what I'm, you know, mm-hmm. talking about, talks about compensation. How can you compensate, right? I mean, because I'm also a linguist. So how can you compensate the damage that's done to a dam that's about 300 square miles, okay? How can you compensate that? So my thesis is actually to reveals, you know, the discursive strategies behind this. But in order to do that, I need scientific facts, like environmental reports or, you know, environmental assessment reports that tells me, like, when you do build a dam like that, you have such and such damage done. Do you guys know of any reliable source? That's my question. You know?
I know, and sort of Steve Hawley. The question was, how do you assess the damage from dams that have already...
talking about the benefits, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. And unfortunately...
Right. What are the costs?
Of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
The loss of it,
you have to... There's a lot of salesmanship that goes not only into dam removal, but to dam building, right? And it's a very interesting question. I think, you know, there were... some very big dams proposed in Chile that were stopped because one of the things that's happened was just growing environmental awareness globally is that the costs of large dam building regimes have become really apparent in a lot of these so-called developing countries, if you want to, you know, I guess America's overdeveloped in that sense. We have way too many dams. But... in terms of really accounting for those costs, that was never done here in the West and in my home river system in the Columbia and Snake. And unfortunately, because that was never accounted for or documented, there was just a, you know, push to build the dams. There are whole, not only ecological communities, but in the lower Snake River corridor alone, there were 22 towns that just disappeared off the face of the earth, and the only way you can find out about these towns is to be lucky enough to talk to somebody who might have lived there or go to the Washington State Historical Society and look for the pictures. That's the only thing that's left. There's a kind of willful amnesia, I think, that happens with dam building regime where it's a, you know, the land that's buried is forgotten. Right? And so one of the really, I guess, joyous things that occurs in a dam removal scenario is that land is revealed again. And so that video you watched was really one of the most amazing things that I saw was there was a Yakima tribal elder whose family had homesteaded land right at the mouth of the White Salmon. And when that dynamite charge went off, he burst into tears. I mean, it was just this huge emotional moment because he had all these, you know, familial memories of that land being, you know, part of his, you know, his family's, literally the weave of their existence and their culture, and it was back, right? And there's trees growing on it now. But that's one thing that hasn't been done, and I think, I don't know, I'd love to talk to you afterwards more about what's happening in Brazil, because I do think that that's causing problems for people that are pitching just the benefits without the costs. Yeah.
And with a lake that size, you know, the impact in the, because it's being built on the, what's called the Xingu River, which has, you know, what do you call it, an ebb and tide flow system of rain, you know, system, like it rains for about 4 or 5 months nonstop, that's the Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it dries out. So the average amount of energy that's going to be generated is like a tenth of the top. So they set it to peak, which is 11,000 megawatts, right?
Yeah.
But the real average is 1,000. So the benefits, you know, I mean, the whole rationale behind this is totally moral. Not to mention, of course, the removal of the Indian communities,
mm-hmm.
all the things that we're talking about, but the destruction. And the Indians are saying, anytime you do that, you stop the river. You have, you know, mosquitoes growing rampantly. You know, and because the fish can go and eat the mosquitoes, so you have an imbalance, right?
Yeah.
It's balanced here. The fish stay downstream, the mosquito stays upstream. So the whole thing is disrupted, and they know that.
Right. There's a quick, just a little tidbit, a statistic. Since the end of the Second World War, we've buried a landmass the size of California globally in large dam building projects. So, you know.
I did want to follow up on your question. As pointed out, you know, that a lot of these dams are older, and there were no environmental studies done, but there is quite a rich scientific, you know, literature database on the effects of dams. There's one book in particular called Damnation by Dr. Will Graff, G-R-A-F, and he has some other books out also. I can't remember the titles of those, but it's a pretty good summarization. It was done by the Heinz, Dr. Will Graff, G-R-A-F, and it has all sorts of scientific references to it, but it is a good kind of compilation and kind of gives you an idea of how these dams are affecting not only the biological processes, but some of the social parts also.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes or so left. A couple of more questions. Yes, ma'am?
So this is a question about writing about dam removal. So I guess there's two mini questions. One is, I'm curious about the sort of politics or sort of mores of, like, does every dam removal get one author that gets the sort of claim?
Good.
And then the second question is just if you could just say a couple words about how you make a dam removal story relevant to people outside that watershed.
Okay, it was a two-part question. The first is what kind of fight goes on to determine who gets to write about each dam removal, which I love that question. And the second question is, I completely forgot the second question.
How do you make it, people want to read the story that are not
outside
of the watershed?
Oh, yeah. How do you make it of interest to people beyond the immediate geographical range? You want Steve?
I'm not right.
You
take this crack.
You did your damn removal before
sure.
I did. So you get
a lot of people have asked me why I didn't include the Elwha dam removal, and it's exactly because of what you're – there was so much – the Park Service was really promoting this as, an event on the order of the Second Coming, and everybody needed to be there to cover it and watch it. And there were so many people that wanted a piece of that to tell that story that it just I don't think the story got told well. It was just Linda Mapes, who's a reporter for the Seattle Times, is writing or has written a book about it, and she's a very good reporter. I'm sure it'll be a very good book. And, ownership, of course, would be a local thing. I think in a lot of cases, we really have to know the the story and the geography of the area, and that definitely gives you a leg up in telling the story of any dam removal. How do you make it interesting to people outside? I don't know. If my book had sold as well in Idaho as it did in the other 49 states, I'd be a wealthy man. So I'm not sure that all dam removal stories have a wider audience. I definitely aimed my book at folks in the Pacific Northwest, and that's fine. I do think, in terms of environmental stories, this has a national, if not international, audience, simply because it's a reflection of a rapid and very significant shift in what people value, right? Again, I came at this story as a, you know, I'm in my 40s now. I read The Monkey Ranch Gang when I was 16 or 17 and thought, you know, that was an environmentalist wet dream back then, right? I mean, tearing out a dam, wow, what a deal. And then people started actually mentioning the idea, and now it's commonplace almost. And so just that shift in what society values, I think, and it is global because the word is kind of out on the cost of these large dam building projects, not to say that they won't be done, but that shift in values is I think, a really important aspect of writing about dam removal. And go ahead.
I want to follow right up on that with my question, which is the difference between Bayou dams and dam removal in this country versus developing nations in Africa and China, where huge dams are going up. Mm-hmm. So can somebody address that?
Who wants to address that?
I'll take a stab at it.
All right.
No, I don't.
We're talking about sort of the cognitive dissonance between the attitudes in this country and in the developing world about dam removal, dam building.
Well, I'm going to answer this question by talking about or mentioning a subject of which I have no knowledge whatsoever. I think there's sort of a group psychology, and I know nothing about group psychology, that happens in countries that are developing. It's like a trophy to have a large dam to sort of, you know, the dams that we have on the Colombian Snake out where I live, I view as sort of Cold War artifacts, right? It was two things. It was sort of a present to ourselves for winning the Second World War, and it was also a symbol of our industrial might, right? So this is a really interesting thing. You can go to the base of Grand Coulee Dam out in the desert in eastern Washington, and during the summertime, they project movies onto the base of the dam, right? And they have this utterly outrageous propaganda film that they show before the feature film of the process of building Grand Coulee Dam. And there's actually this animated dancing salmon that, you know, it's just this really ironic thing, this dam that wiped out what was once the richest salmon, Chinook salmon run in the world, wiped out immediately half of its habitat as soon as they closed the gates on it. There's this animated dancing salmon going across the base of it, right? And so I think what's happening is that people, you know, unfortunately the United States sort of set this trend as a sort of symbol of your economic and cultural and political prowess in the world. You build a monument to, you know, to your nation, essentially.
Can I follow up on that just a little bit?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think this probably might need to be said. Garrett talked a little bit about removal of these dams being relics of America's industrial past. Well, that's a function of America increasingly having become a post-industrial society. A lot of times you're seeing these dams, and when we were a budding industrial society, we were not removing dams, we were not talking about salmon. It's not like the science was necessarily beyond us, but it was not a value that we were interested in. We were building the biggest dams we could build as fast and as frequently as we could. And I think that's a function of where the American economy was at the time. And that's not where the economy of the developing world, broadly speaking, necessarily is now. So I think to a certain degree, whatever you think of America's place in sort of its post-pre-mid-industrial development, Dam removal is, to a certain extent, a luxury of the fact that these are monuments to an economy that is not primarily our economy anymore. When you get into the developing world, when you get into the electrifying world, when you get India, China, other places in the world, that in a lot of ways, I mean, I hate to paint with a broad stroke, and I'm not experts on these countries, but in a lot of ways are where America was industrially 100 years ago or so. And they are going through the same building spurts. They are going through the same resource extraction and development that this country was going through 100 years ago. They're not where we are now. We're not where they are. And to get back to your question about how do you sort of universalize these questions, this interest, what I tried to do here is sort of draw that connection that in this little microcosm of Opportunity Montana, which does not have a reader base, you have an example that you can extrapolate globally. What happened here is happening in China now. What happened here 100 years ago is happening in parts of China now, for example. And the cleanup that we're going through and the difficulties that we go through with this cleanup are cautionary tales for what we're going to see later in other parts of the world. So I think it's I think that's worth saying. We're just not in the same economy that we were, and we're not in the same economy that large parts of the world are. And there's a certain difficulty in sitting here from our position and saying what other countries should do now that we've already done it and certainly benefited, well, certainly received the pros and cons of the consequences of that development.
You're saying that these developing nations are not listening to our cautionary tale. They're just sort of coming in and saying, I don't want to hear it.
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to speak about what they are doing, but it is pretty, it's kind of fact on the ground that in terms of industrial development, they're going through a process that we went through 100 years ago. And it's a little bit hypocritical to say, it would be if somebody were saying that, hey, don't develop that quality of life right. that we did for yourselves, because we've discovered in the meantime that it's really dirty and destructive. So, you know, do without all the mid-century appliances and conveniences that we came up with, your water heaters, your air conditioners, your refrigerators. You know, it complicates the question.
Right. And can I also follow up? One other thing that really where we are in the United States is that all the good dam building sites have been used. I mean, you know, when you look at where there's water supply for the hydropower generation, where there's the kind of slope, the relief that you need to be able to get, you know, the way you generate electricity is through falling water. So you need the difference between the head of the reservoir and where the turbines are. You know, the sites have been mapped out and the good ones have been taken. So in a lot of these developing countries, there's still opportunity to put these things at the best locations because they haven't been taken. There was a big push in the 80s, a federal law called PURPA that actually supported these small hydropower dams. Almost all of them, once the federal funding went away, they went belly up because those old projects that had been abandoned were abandoned because they weren't economically viable. And when the government support to revitalize those plants went away, they all, you know, a lot of them went out of business. And so, again, it's just that we have done a damn good job of damming up our rivers for the hydropower purposes, and there aren't that many great opportunities to build new, highly productive, highly profitable projects.
And on that, I think we have to wrap it up, although I and maybe these gentlemen would be happy to stay after if somebody doesn't have other plans, but we've reached the end of our time, and some of you folks probably have places to be. Thank you all very much.
Thanks.